relationship with me because she thought I would end up dead by running through Iran. And also my sister was very worried. She called me asking how she would take care of mom and dad and their sorrow if I would never come back from Iran. But these were actually the fears that I wanted to challenge. So I did not allow them to stop me. But instead I tried to do whatever I could to make my friend and my sister and my parents to feel safe. Because I really believe that we do have one Earth. We do have one humanity. We as people are the same, no matter which country, culture, religion, or whatever. And that is what I wanted to show, so that's why I had to go. So the more I thought about it, the more I liked the idea of creating trust, because I think we have a world where terrorists, for instance, wants to polarize between the Western world and the Muslim world, and I don't like that. I think we are one human race, and let's do what's best for our planet. So my run through Iran was actually to counteract fear between people and to create trust between people. And, well, I was posting a blog post on Facebook and other social media about what my idea, and as soon as I did that, I had two different reactions. Most people became afraid and said, you cannot do that, that's crazy. But some people became very interested. For instance, André, a journalist, and also, well, 10 to 15 other persons said, wow, this is so great. And we want to work with you to create this trip.
When I first got this information about Christina running through Iran, I didn't realize she was telling truth, because I didn't realize it was going to happen. And there were so much problems always, getting visa and getting able to connect with the country. But finally she got this visa, and just 1 week before, she bought the air ticket. Okay, and then finally she just went to Iran, and I was most afraid that she would be having a car crash and injured in a car accident, but because I know there's a lot of traffic in Iran. So I was never afraid that she wouldn't take care of herself, because she's very capable of doing that. And the information I got from her during the trip was always positive, almost the time, actually.
Actually, I had more than 15 people in Sweden who were helping me to, well, do my web page, to formulate my communication, how to reach out to the press in Sweden, in Europe, in other countries as well. And so it was wonderful to see how all these persons who also believe in humankind wanted to contribute to make this a trip that a lot of people would hear of. But we didn't know if I was going to succeed or not when I started. So it was really exciting to see what was going to happen. First day I was a little bit scared, I have to say, and I think that was mainly due to that I was alone in a foreign country that I knew nothing about. I'm from Sweden, I'm not used to the heat. So I was sweating a lot, and I was a little bit surprised. I knew it was going to be warm, but not that warm. So I had a breakdown after 1 kilometer when I sat down and cried and cried and cried a lot. Running, and I was feeling lonely, and I think it was 45 degrees Celsius, and I lay down beneath a plum tree, and I was laying there and eating fruit and just listening to music. And then my friend Karina, she called me And I was so happy to hear her voice. And so I was laying there for 2 hours thinking that, okay, maybe I will spend most of the hot hours just laying here in the shade. But it turned out that when I started running again, which was at 4 o'clock, that was the hottest time. So that was horrible. But that evening I reached a Red Crescent station, and I had a shower there, and the guys at the station, they took care of me, gave me food, and I was so relieved because I'd been running 41 kilometers in a terrible heat. But it was friendly people in the restaurant where I was eating, and I was offered food at the restaurant too. They didn't let me pay. They just placed a lot of food in front of me, and I ate for free. And when I was in a shop, the guy who was running the shop, he wanted my telephone number so he could help me. I could call him and he could help me along the way if I would have trouble with the language and things like that. And then when I continued running, I met a friendly man who gave me tea. And then when I found a camping site that evening, the guy at the camping site, he gave me his lunch. And I was really surprised, and I felt very happy because he was so kind to me. So actually the first day was really, well, it was a lot of hospitality, and I was so grateful because I think it's really important to greet someone who is a little bit afraid, who is a little bit scared, with friendliness, and that made all the difference. I started my run in Basagan on the border towards Turkey, and from there I ran towards Tabriz, then to Ardabil and Astara, and then I followed the Caspian Sea all along the shore, and I passed through Gorgan and all the way to, well, Gorgan through Golestan National Park and then to Kuchan. And in Kuchan I turned towards Turkmenistan and ran towards the border in Bashkiran. So it was a distance of approximately 1,840 kilometers, and it took me 59 days to run it. So my memories from my run through Iran is mainly the general incredible hospitality that I met along the road. I was weighing 70 kilos when I went to Iran, and I was weighing 70 kilos when I came back home because people had given me so much food. So that was actually enormous after running 1,840 kilometers. But of course I did have some slight problems along the way too. I did not understand the language. I'm not very good at Persian, unfortunately. And I did have some troubles communicating. Fears I had before I left Sweden was actually about that people might be angry with me because of what I did, might assault me, might hit me, who knows. I was having a lot of terrible prejudice, which I was ashamed for a while. I've been running through lots of countries, in Bulgaria, Romania, Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, but the run through Iran was actually the one with most, that was most, where I met most people, and so incredible people in terms of hospitality.
When I'm sitting at the restaurant and eating, I was very happy to find food because it was my longest day. I was running from Ardabil to Astara, and it was 86 kilometers of running, and it was pretty tough because it was I think it was 4.5 hours uphill. I have received so much fruit that my baby jogger is incredibly heavy. I have been given fruit, berries, cookies, sunflower seeds, and it's just so much, so it's difficult to run with it.
I slept in 34 different families' homes, which is incredible in my mind, and that never happened. I mean, the other countries were generous and friendly as well, but I think the generosity and the hospitality in Iran was extreme.
A woman I met in the desert, and she was a poor woman. She didn't have much, but she shared her food with me. She shared her home. And then these two women, they walked with me for a couple of kilometers, and then I could sleep in their home for the other night, and then I ran away to another family. In the evening, I was allowed to sleep in the home of one of those guys, and his mother and his sister were sleeping with me outside on the porch, and we were laying there under the sky just watching how the stars lit up one after one after one, and it was so peaceful to just lay there and look at the stars together with them. So that is one very beautiful memory. And actually, I did have a budget of 25,000 Swedish crowns when I went to Iran, but I only used 12,000, so a little bit less than half. And also, people gave me gifts. I went to Iran with 25 kilos of luggage. I came home with 40, and so I had more than 50 kilos of gifts, but I couldn't carry all the gifts, unfortunately. So not all of them ended up in my home, but they ended up in my heart, and they're still there.
I thought that when I came home, this trip was supposed to be over, but actually this is where it kind of started. I wanted to write about each and every person that I had met that had been nice to me. This is the book that I wrote about my run through Iran. And as I said, it was 800 pages first when I wrote about everyone that I met. But now it's 304 pages. And usually, I say a normal lecture is where people first cry, and then they are happy. And they cry out of joy because of all the friendliness they see in the lecture and in the book. And I was also very happy that the book is translated. It's translated to the Czech language, and also it's translated to Dutch. It's also right now translated to Spanish, and I think it's more than 500 million people in the world that speak Spanish that's now able to read about this run. And it will also be translated to German, to Slovenian, and also to Persian.
I would be really interested in visiting Iran, and, mm-hmm. and you being my guide, and showing all the cities you have run through, or some of them at least. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be nice, actually.
Would you like to run there?
Maybe not running, just visiting and having a good time, eating good food, and meeting people, and seeing the landscape and so on. That would be nice.
It turned out that my run did get an incredible attention in media in Sweden, in Europe, and I would say all around the world except for Antarctica. And the biggest success was actually when The Guardian made a video about this run, and when they released it, it had 10 million views in only 2 weeks. In general, I would say that media displays threats, fears, bad things, and I mean our brain are designed for survival, so it reacts 5 times more to threats and violence and fears than it does to trust and love. So that's why media sell a lot of bad news, so to say. And I think that's the reason also why, well, some countries are displayed as evil in other countries' media. And for me, that's to make the world black and white. That's not the correct description. For instance, if I, my view of Iran before I went there was that I was supposed to be scared. And when I ask, when I tell people that I've been running through Iran, a lot of people say, wow, how did you dare to do that? And I always wonder, why do you ask that question? I mean, we are people. No matter if we are born in Sweden or born in Iran, we are people. That's it. And we have a choice. We have a choice to do good things or bad things, and we can choose differently. But most people choose to do good things. But those things never end up in the newspapers. They don't end up in the media. And I think media sometimes is used to polarize countries towards each other, and I don't really like that. I want media to describe the truth. And the truth is that most people are just normal, everyday people, like you and me. My one reflection from my Iran run is that people just want to raise their children, create a good economy, create a good life for themselves and their children. And that's about it. And that's what the majority of the people in the world wants. But that's never displayed in media. So 99.5% of what the world is about is never displayed. I wish we had a different media that shows both. I want to say thank you to the entire Iranian people for showing me such a great hospitality when I was running through Iran. It's been a wonderful journey to experience the generosity and the kindness of the Iranian people. And I think that's something that you should really be proud of yourself for this great kindness that you're showing to people from all over the world. So keep on doing that, because you're wonderful. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Khomeini and his personal life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about some of the aspects of the personal life of Imam Khomeini, and to see how he used to live, how he was in his personal life. We can see that from his children, from his daughters and the sons, we have many things which are said. And even from his wife, there are many things which are said, which shows us how he was in his personal life. It is very clear that Imam Khomeini was loving his wife, and he paid attention to his kids. Even his daughter said that when there was a time to study, and if I would spend more time in studying, he used to stop me, and he used to say, there is a time for entertainment and there is a time for study. Do not mix these two times with each other. You should do everything on its own time. On the other hand, she says that once my mother was ill, and he used to have tea in the courtyard. Therefore, my mother used to bring tea at a specific place in the courtyard. On the day when she was sick, I changed that place and I put the tea in some other place. When Imam Khomeini came to the courtyard, he said to me, "Why did you change the place where your mother used to put the tea? And I will take tea at the same place. Do not change the things in the way your mother has put it." Therefore, it shows the respect of wife, and it shows the respect of the family members within the family in the life of Imam Khomeini.
Congratulations to all Muslims across the world on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Listen to our special programs on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the life of Imam Khomeini and his personal life. Now, in his personal life, when we look at the different aspects of his life, we can see that once his wife said that Imam Khomeini was loving his wife and he used to respect his wife a lot. And she said that in the beginning of our life, Imam Khomeini has said to me that I do not have to do anything with you, I do not stop you from doing anything, and you can wear the clothes the way you want, you can go wherever you want, but remember, do not go toward the guna and do not perform the forbidden things. If you are performing the allowable things only, the wajibat only, the permissible things, and if you are doing everything within the boundaries of Islam, that is enough for me. I even don't want you to do mustahabbat, which is something extraordinary. So what I expect you is to, the minimum expectation of me from you is to just do what Islam says and do not perform any guna. And this is my expectation from you. And she says that he never stopped her from doing anything because she was taking care of the wajibat. She was not performing any forbidden things. And therefore she said, we had a very happy life. Even if I wanted to go and visit my friends, or if my friends were visiting me, he never stopped me. He never stopped me. And on the other hand, I never stopped him or became a hurdle in the way of learning and teaching. So this shows us the love of a couple which has been shown in the life of Imam Khomeini. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, 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 Allah.
إن الذين قالوا ربنا الله ثم استقاموا تتنزل عليهم الملائكة.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
The variants rapid spread, different vaccine strategies, and varying levels of immunity worldwide make the pandemic's future difficult to model, says David Adam, writer, in an article published under the heading, Will Omicron End the Pandemic? Here's what experts say. Stay tuned for more. On January 11th, just 7 weeks after the Omicron variant was first reported, the World Health Organization, WHO, warned of a tidal wave of infection washing from west to east across the world. 50 of the 53 countries in Europe and Central Asia had reported cases of Omicron, said Hans-Henry Klug, the WHO's regional director for Europe. Countries would have to cope as best they could, he said, guided by their individual epidemiological situation, available resources, vaccination uptake status, and socio-economic context. In recent weeks, countries in Europe and the United States have felt the full force of Omicron wave. In the UK, which has reported most infections, daily COVID-19 cases peaked at more than 160,000 earlier this month. Scientists there say all nations are facing the same major problem: the sheer speed at which the variant spreads. And although the WHO and others have suggested that huge numbers of Omicron infections could signal the end of the pandemic because of the short-term surge in immunity that will follow, researchers warn that the situation remains volatile and difficult to model. It moves so fast that it gives very little time to prepare any kind of response, so decisions have to be made under huge uncertainty, says Graham Medley, an infectious diseases modeler at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who advises the UK government. Numbers of Omicron infections can double in less than 2 days, which is significantly faster than previous SARS-CoV-2 variants and closer to what public health officials would expect from the milder influenza virus. One scientist says Omicron is flu on acid. We haven't seen that speed before, and it meant you couldn't vax your way out of it, adds Christina Pagel, a healthcare data analyst at University College London, adding, even if you could vax everybody, it still takes 2 weeks for the vaccine to kick in, and by then you are in the middle of it. That places policymakers and researchers who advise them in an unenviable position. It was a situation where you either put it in restrictions very, very early or you do nothing, Pagel says, adding, but if you wait to see what happens, then it's too late. Along with other countries, Britain tightened regulations in December, but it was a controversial move, particularly because reports from South Africa, which was hit by Omicron the previous month, suggested that the variant seemed to cause less severe illness and hospitalization, a conclusion now supported by the experience of the UK and other places. UK modelers were initially torn about how to use information from South Africa. It's relatively straightforward to update a computer model to account for changes in the biological properties of a new variant. However, as the pandemic has progressed, it has become much harder to simulate the baseline immune response of a country's population and so to judge how that will limit spread. In the early days of the pandemic, researchers could assume that most people worldwide were equally susceptible to infection because COVID-19 was a new disease and no vaccines were available. But 12 months of different vaccine strategies, types and take-up rates from country to country, as well as fluctuating rates of infection and recovery, have left a diverse immunological landscape. The probability that infection will put someone in hospital is absolutely a key parameter, but we are now estimating that in an obviously not naive population, says Mark Woolhouse, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Edinburgh, UK, who also advises the government, adding, when you are making those sorts of estimates, formally you really should remake them for every population you're interested in, and that applies everywhere. Modelers were confounded by the lack of specifics in South African data about reduced severity. There was no quantitative analysis, Woolhouse says, adding, so, what numbers do you plug in? Are you saying 10% less pathogenic, or 50% less, or 90% less? Still, speaking in a personal capacity, Woolhouse says that some influential modelers in the UK were wrong not to allow for any reduced severity, instead working with assumed hospitalization rates for Omicron that were identical to those of previous variants. That's clearly a pessimistic assumption, he says, adding, I do not think it could have been much clearer from the beginning that there was this possibility it was less pathogenic. And you know, being crystal clear on what the policy implications of that difference might be. The heterogeneity in immunological baselines and other important factors such as population dynamics from country to country make it difficult to predict international spread of Omicron with any precision or to assess, for example, how the variant might take hold in countries with lower vaccination rates. It's very hard to answer that question, says Julian Tang, a consultant virologist at the Leicester Royal Infirmary, UK. And it's not very useful because if you say it's spreading in pattern X, Y, Z across Western Europe and then A, B, C across North America and M and O in Africa, that doesn't really help anybody. The waning protection against infection that vaccines offer against Omicron also complicates the picture. Lab studies have indicated that inactivated virus vaccines, which make up almost half of the 10 billion doses distributed worldwide, elicit few antibodies against the variant. Does that mean that Omicron will rip through places that rely on these shots even faster? Not necessarily, says Woolhouse. The inactivated virus vaccines might induce a broader immunity that would react to a wider range of strains because it will elicit immune responses against viral proteins other than spike, which is particularly variable, he says. It's a very interesting question, but I simply haven't seen a formal analysis of it yet. That's because there are few real-world data to go on. It's only just hitting countries that have used them, says Pagel. Among the countries that rely on inactivated virus vaccines, Omicron seems to be making the most headway in the Philippines, which saw an exponential rise in COVID-19 cases this month, particularly in Manila. The number of new infections in the capital does not seem to be dropping, but the virus is spreading farther afield. Definitely cases are slowing down in the national capital region, but in other regions it is now increasing, said Maria Rosario Veregui, health spokesperson for the Philippines government. Vaccination rates are still relatively low in the Philippines, with 53% of the population fully vaccinated. Officials dare say they want to vaccinate all the country's 77 million adults by May. Although vaccines are likely to continue protecting against severe symptoms, Pagel says, infection will continue to spread, adding, I think the assumption is that none of the vaccines are going to give you long-lasting protection against infection. Tang agrees, saying, I don't think vaccines are the way this pandemic is going to end. So how will it end? Not with Omicron, researchers predict. This will not be the last variant, and so the next variant will have its own characteristics, Medley says. Given that the virus is unlikely to disappear completely, COVID-19 will inevitably become an endemic disease, scientists say. But that's a slippery concept, and one that means different things to different people. I think it's the expectation that the general behavior is somehow towards the situation where we have so much immunity in the population that we would no longer see very deadly epidemics, says Sebastian Funk, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The transition to endemicity, or living with the virus without restrictions and safeguards, is difficult to model with any accuracy, he adds. That's partly because even the best disease models struggle to make sensible forecasts beyond a few weeks ahead. It's also because endemicity reflects a judgment call on how many deaths societies are willing to tolerate while the global population steadily builds up immunity. For Woolhouse, COVID-19 will truly become endemic only when more adults are protected against severe infection because they have been exposed multiple times to the virus as children and so have developed natural immunity. That will take decades, and it means many older people today who were not exposed as children will remain vulnerable and might need continued vaccinations. That strategy has its flaws. Some of those exposed as children will develop long COVID. And it relies on children continuing to show much lower rates of severe illness as variants evolve. There are no guarantees that the next variant will be milder. But Tang says that seems to be the pattern so far. He says this virus is getting milder and milder with each iteration.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadiri and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program we discuss problems and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children As usual, most of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, supplemented with the scientific data. Joining us in the studio is our guest speaker, an Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear listeners, we will be talking about the fifth mistake some parents make. And I say some, because you will find out shortly why, when they are raising their children. And that being, as I like to put it, changing the rules of engagement at whim. Meaning, when the parent wants to physically, unfortunately, punish their child, instead of keeping the punishment to something that is known, something the usual punishment, the routine punishment, they change the physical punishment at a whim, thus throwing the child out of balance and completely turning the world that this child is living in upside down. Dear Sayyid, please teach us how to avoid this situation.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. There are a lot of parents, sadly, their method of dealing with their kids is through violence, and some of them, they get very harsh with their kids. I mean, this is a reality that we can't escape, we cannot deny. And as much as we try to cover our tub, this can't be covered. Right. And this is a global issue, mind you. This not only happens in a certain culture or certain society.
No.
Maybe certain cultures or certain countries, they have less of it. Right. But over across the board, it's a common problem, very common problem.
Unfortunately.
And obviously, you know, it's not like children, they're going to call the police or down
call the United Nations
or 999. Obviously, right. They, you know. So yeah, we just cooperate.
So
I speak for myself. I've been here a lot. So as children, you know, we get hit. But sometimes some parents, they don't understand the rules of engagement and hitting a child. And sometimes they start to hit them too much. Sometimes they start to throw things at them. Right. They throw a cup, a glass, a shoe, whatever they see.
Whatever's within reach.
And this is what I call guided missiles, right? So you have a shoe. This is a guided missile,
right?
And I've seen many of, and I've seen them even in public. I've seen many people even around the shrines of the imams with their kids, and they pull them from their ears, or they give them a slap and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah.
So this is a problem that we have that is, you know, needs to be treated.
Right.
Now, obviously, we did mention many times that we said hitting a child is forbidden in Islam. You can't hit a child, and if you hit, obviously you have to pay compensation, reimbursement in gold and silver, depending on the color that changes when the child has been hit.
Dear Sayyid, allow me to interrupt you because we'll be going on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the fifth mistake parents commit when they are raising their children, and that is when they want to unfortunately physically punish their children, they change the way that they punish their children. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
So we were saying that Islamically it forbids a parent hitting his children under no circumstances.
Right.
And we see that most people sadly do, they neglect that, they disregard that order of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and this is a very important point, when it comes to girls, He set the age of taklif, of Islamic maturity and puberty at the age of 9.
Right.
And set it for the boys at the age of 15. It could be less depending on the boy, but technically speaking, we go 15, right?
Right.
So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, He says, before 9, I will not punish you for whatever sin you commit, because you're not mature.
Right, yeah.
Right? Once you become mature, I require you to pray, I require you to fast, I require you, if you don't do these requirements, you get punishment.
Yeah.
So even maturity, after maturity, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, from here I can begin. Now, even Allah says, even so though He says, I will punish you for not praying, that punishment is delayed. It's not instant, right?
Right.
With parents, why don't we have the same limitation as Allah has? For example, I should not touch my child unless he's 15, or if she's a girl, unless she's 9. Not that I'm saying we should.
Not that you shouldn't, but like exactly. At least think, if you're going to do it.
Exactly. Why don't we think it of in the same way of Allah?
Right.
Or as we say, okay, you know what? He made a mistake. We can let it go. We can try to fix it.
Right.
And even if I have to do a punishment, let me delay the punishment.
Yeah.
Don't make it instant. So then we ask questions here. We say, what did these children do so bad that they deserve to be hit physically? And is it natural for a child to be hit from year to year to year? Because, you know, sometimes once a parent hits once, twice, and becomes a habit, usually they start, right?
Right, unfortunately.
I have 3 kids myself, and I never laid hands on them. And, you know, they do a lot of stupid things.
Right.
I never lay a hand on them because, first, I know my Islamic duties.
Your Islamic obligations, of course.
And I know the effect it will leave on them mentally. They will grow up with it.
And that is just as important.
Yeah. And if the child, obviously, as he grows older, he does not try to program himself to forget, it stays with him. So maybe sometimes me and you, we love our dad so much that we kind of forget what they done to
right.
us.
Yeah, yeah. Selective memory.
Yeah, but some kids, it grows with them. They take it with them to the grave. And I've had a lot of people even curse their fathers.
Right.
And I was just recently speaking to a young boy who was having a rough time with his dad, and he told me, you know, the time that his dad bashed him so much because he came home late because he was with his friends.
Just for that.
Yeah, and he said he was in the car. He said he was sitting in the car in the train station, and he said dad just grabbed him by the side, pushing my head against the dashboard and hitting me with the phone. It's like, it's a very violent scene for about a 10-year-old.
Right, for anyone, really.
Yeah, and this and his dad is a religious man. And I said...
Is he, though?
I said, what went wrong?
Yeah, is he, though, if you will, really was a religious man?
I don't know.
Right. With that, let's go ahead and take a quick break to cool our heartbeats.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Just before we went on a break, we were discussing the 5th mistake that some parents make, unfortunately, very unfortunately, and when they are physically punishing their children, they sometimes choose to switch up their punishment in unexpected ways. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further in regards to this subject.
And then we asked, what is the reason to why parents hit their children? If a parent hits his child, it shows how much this parent lacks in terms of trying to find other solution and other ways to deal with his child.
Right.
It tells you how ignorant he is in dealing with his child, that this is his only method of trying to deal with the child.
Right.
For example, in the case that I said to you before with the child coming late, I mean, if you resolve to hitting straight away, then obviously you're a failure as a father. I don't right. care how religious you are.
I completely agree.
But you are a failure. I mean,
as a father and as a human being.
I yeah, like so a 10-year-old, I mean, there are better ways to deal with them. So, for example, if a person, his children lack at school, and he resorts to hitting them, for example, right? Some people do that. I mean, why don't you sit with them, figure out why they slow, and try to work on that, and bring them up to level, to speed. If you hit them, it just tells me that you are incapable of thinking to begin with.
Right.
Because, you know, the only thing you do is hit.
Right.
This is an animal.
Just like an animal.
It's an animal instinct.
Right.
The animal, if you try to get close to an animal, the first thing an animal would do is like tries to hit you. Have you seen a cat when you're trying to touch your cat, especially if he's not friendly?
Yeah.
The first thing we'll do to try to hit you. Scratch you.
Yeah.
Natural call. So if I come and my natural reaction to my child's problem is to straight away hit them.
It is mind blowing.
That's a problem.
Just treat the child the parents who want to hit their children, like, imagine this is an adult sitting in front of you.
Yeah.
Are we going to act the same way? Are we really going to hit an adult?
Yeah. And sometimes even, let's change the scenario around. Sometimes two siblings are fighting, one of the siblings hits the other. The mother comes like an eagle and she slaps the child that hit his sibling.
Right.
I'm okay. We say, well, I mean, why do you have to get involved? It's not your business.
Right.
It's between them. They're fighting. You don't have to hit. What you could do, though, you could have separated them when they were arguing.
Why are you involved in the fighting?
Yeah.
Like, so when physically fighting.
When you heard the argument, where you had things, you try to work it out. Try to work what the problem is. Try to find a solution.
Right.
Right. I mean, obviously, if they got to a point where one is hitting the other, it did not just escalate instantly.
It's not out of the blue.
Right? So I started, you know, an argument, this and that, and then blew out of proportion. It happened with my kids a lot. And what I do is I try to de-escalate the situation. Yeah,
find out what's going on.
Yeah, and find the other
de-escalation.
Solution.
You taught this skill when de-escalating a conflict.
Yeah.
You separate both parties, you sit them down, they get calm, you ask them what has happened.
Exactly. So this is what you have to do. So if I just have to resort to every time my daughter, she's a kind of a bully. Every time she hits her brother, I have to go hit her. Oh, sometimes when her brother retaliates and he hits her, then I hit him.
Sounds so stupid when you put it that way.
Yeah, right. So that just, it's not going to solve the problem.
A hit B and I come and C hit B. And
yeah, so it's just a never-ending dilemma.
It's a never-ending cycle.
Yeah, so with parents who always resort to this act of hitting, then obviously they have a problem. Right. They like
grow up
a problem. Themselves. Yeah, and sometimes, right. For example, mothers hit their children when they're eating. Like, because he eats in a certain way,
right.
And he gets a certain slap, because I'm like, let him eat, teach him how to eat, don't
teach
hit him.
Him.
So obviously, whatever we hit our children for, there's a very simple solution to. But we just need to open our eyes. If we're not seeing it, then we are truly dumb.
And may Allah guide us to the straight path where we are not so much dumb. And with that note, we will have to end today's program. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time and for your valuable information and knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If your dear listeners have any questions or comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir, or you can visit our website parsabay.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media websites, such as on Instagram and Twitter, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for joining us.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.